Hello everyone, and welcome to A Wish Come Clear's You Need to Read video interview series. And today I'm thrilled to be speaking with writer and blogger Addy Zierman. Addy is one of my all-time favorite authors, and she has published two beautiful memoirs, When We Were on Fire and Night Driving. And my copies are dog-eared and very much loved. So Addy writes about faith reimagined at her blog, addyzierman.com. So welcome, Addy.
Thank you. It's fun to be here.
Thanks for taking the time. And I mean, I can't say enough good things. And I'm just so grateful to you for all of your writing and just for being a kindred spirit.
Oh, agreed. I have loved getting to know you a little bit lately too. So
thank you. All right. Well, let's dive right in and help some of our readers and listeners get to know you better too. So your first memoir, When We Were on Fire, it's about your journey from an evangelical poster child to a depressed, angry, raging young adult. It's about getting burned out on one form of faith and seeking another that feels more real and more true. So can you talk about how that book got started and what really led you to write that story?
Well, I wrote that book actually in grad school. It was my grad school thesis. I went to grad school just because I had always wanted to get more writing education and stuff like that. My husband and I had just come back from China. A lot of things fell into place, and so I started going to a night program at Hamline University for my MFA. And while I was there, things really sort of fell apart with my faith journey. And we were in the middle of this really fruitless, awful, soul-crushing church hunt, search, shopping, whatever. Mm-hmm. I was starting to really struggle with depression, though I didn't have really language for it yet. Just a lot of things were happening, and I was super mad at God because I felt like he had sort of abandoned me, and I'd done everything right, and I'd done all the things, and he was nowhere, and the church people were mean, and, you know, there was no community for me, and so there was a lot of resentment, and, but then I was at grad school, specifically for memoir, because I really love creative nonfiction, always have, ever since I discovered it in my undergrad. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, when you go to school to learn to write memoir, and you've been a super Christian for your whole life, it's going to come up. And so I just found that it was what was coming up. It wasn't something I set out to write about. In fact, I kind of went to grad school to break into new territory, but I, of course I can't. You can't escape your story or who you are. And so I often tell people that grad school was the way that God, I feel like, kind of kept the conversation open with because I was really at a point where I was ready to run, but I couldn't because I had to write about, you know, being a Jesus freak. So
nice.
So yeah, I wrote that over the years I was at grad school in the middle of a lot of therapy. A lot of it was happening as I wrote, and then that became later on When We Were on Fire.
I love that. And actually, it's interesting. Until you said that, I had not made the connection that the memoir that I'm working on kind of came out of writing assignments at college where, yeah, they had us write about our challenges and our families, and I did not want to go there. But that is so interesting that that was, you know, what kept you in that relationship with God even when you were ready to bolt.
It's pretty cool.
Wow. Wow. And so there are so many things to love about your first book. One of the parts that particularly resonated with me is how you wrote about your relationship with your first boyfriend, who you call Chris, in the book. And I really appreciated how it feels very honest and it feels very real to me. Some of the control dynamics, some of kind of the psychological, spiritual manipulation, but yet it also feels compassionate toward yourself and toward him. So I was curious, what was it like for you to put yourself back in that place and to write about that particular relationship?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, when I started the writing process during my undergrad, there was a lot of anger there and a lot of, you know, just kind of discovering how much that relationship in particular, along with everything else, had sort of formed me in certain ways, and just discovering the manipulative aspects of it a little bit more, naming them a little bit more. There was a lot of anger and pain and stuff that came out of that. So a lot of my earlier drafts are quite a bit meaner.
Nice, nice.
But as the therapy continued and as my own faith journey continued, you know, it was actually a couple of, well, I can't remember how many years, a couple of years after my thesis before I got my book deal. I got an agent quickly, but my book deal took much longer. And so during that time, I was kind of building a faith community, at least in the blogging world, and I was doing a lot of healing. And I think that the compassion that comes through for him was a result of that. Like it, as I began to understand and I guess forgive myself, I was able to, I mean, he was 17, you know, we're so dumb at 17. And he didn't know what he was doing. None of us knew what we were doing. We thought we all were doing the best that we could. And so I really feel none of that anymore. I think writing really was a road to healing for me about that. What he thinks, who knows, but you know, for me, it was great. So,
yes, yes, I love that. Writing as a road to healing. I totally agree with that. And I just realized I hadn't written this on my initial set of questions, but it's sort of the obvious one. I wanted to ask about your work as the kind of advice columnist slash spiritual columnist at Off the Page, because a lot of people write to you with these very painful faith experiences, and you do kind of the Cheryl Strayed, Dear Sugar, radical empathy from the faith perspective. And yeah, what has that been like for you to be the on the other side, like giving me words of wisdom?
It's been lovely. There is something really interesting about having a specific person's specific story that you are kind of rubbing up against with your own stuff. It's just, it's a lot different than just coming at a topic, you know, on your own. It feels more conversational. It feels more intimate. It feels, I love it. I feel totally unqualified to be doing it. Right? What I'm doing, but it's so much fun. I agonize about my, they take me forever, but in the end, they're always good. So.
That's comforting to hear, because they always come out sounding very wise and very focused, but that's comforting to hear that it takes some struggle to get there.
Yes, it takes a long time, so.
Yeah. I also think that's sort of the perfect bumper sticker line for the ideal job. I feel completely unqualified, and I love it. And so, actually, that leads to another question that I've wondered about in your writing. So you're really good about kind of diving into some potentially sensitive topics, like you write about your relationship with drinking or with flirting or with doubt, like things that many of us have experienced, but a lot of people don't go there and just kind of stay on the surface. So yeah, I wanted to ask maybe how you decide, all right, is this something I feel ready to share? How does that process go for you?
It's a great question. A good question. My first book, because it took so long between the writing and the actual putting it out there, I felt pretty ready for it. You know, I was still very nervous, and I felt very exposed. With my second book, I had gotten a 2-book deal, and so the second book was on such a accelerated timeline, and so I did feel like a lot of that stuff went out there before I was totally ready for it too, and so. That was really hard. That was a big learning curve thing for me, and I'll do it differently next time, because it does. It takes time to get yourself ready to share that stuff and to be okay with how people respond to it. I always would rather err on the side of sharing too much, just because I think that It gives us, we are honest with each other. It gives us the courage to be honest with ourselves. I just think it's such an important part of our human connection is this honesty and this sharing. However, you know, there is wisdom that needs to also come alongside that. And I feel like I'm struggling with it a lot now because my kids are older. My son, Bane, is about to be 8. My littlest is about to be 6. And so a lot of the things that consume my own, even my own spiritual journey, which is what I usually blog about, have to do with them. And so that feels really different and really tricky. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's easier if it's just, oh, this is a story about me and this experience that I had. But as soon as there are other players in the game, the complexity just ratchets up. But I love that concept of kind of erring on the side of being a little more open, because it reminds me of one of my favorite parts in your first book is you are visiting a church and trying to connect with people, and you're having a really rough time, and they're playing a get to know you game. If you were a fruit, what would you be? And you're like, I am dying, basically. And the church people are talking about fruit, and like, I can't handle it. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what you said. And yes, so in that scenario, it would have been, you know, much more favorable if someone had invited you to have a deeper conversation rather than talking about fruit.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's so silly. I mean, and part of it was where I was, you know, but I also think, you know, especially in our own church communities, being the first one to go first, be like, you know, I don't want to talk about fruit. I'm having the shittiest time. Like, I think that enables other people to be like, oh my gosh, me too. You know, and that is where that community is formed. Not in icebreakers.
Yeah.
And just diving in, you know.
Definitely. And it takes a lot of courage to be that first one to break the ice and dive in. So you mentioned your second one more, Night Driving, which is, if folks haven't read it, they need to, but it's about an epic road trip that you took with Dane and Liam when they were quite a bit younger. And along the way, you wrestle with questions about faith, doubt, light, darkness. An iPhone gets dropped into the toilet full of poop. It's wonderful. So if you could just introduce folks to how did you decide to take that trip and then what led you to write about it?
The trip was totally spontaneous. I did not go on a trip to write about it. It was not a writing experiment sort of thing. It was the worst winter of all time in Minnesota. It was the year of the polar vortex. If you remember that, it affected us all, but especially in Minnesota, it was like out of control cold. And my depression was back, and I was so frustrated because I felt like I'd done so much work, you know, to get through, you know, and to be honest with myself and to heal. And for the love of God, why can't I get through this depression thing? And why am I, why do I always feel this way? And then I had this 4 and this 2-year-old, and they were just bananas. They were bouncing on the walls, and I was, like, drinking too much, and it was a problem. So I was like, you know what? If I'm going to be a stay-at-home mom, then, like, I'm going to go with the perks of that, and we're just going to go. And my husband, who's a big adventure guy, was like, do it! And so we did. And so, you know, I drove, and I stayed with friends, and, you know, it seemed a lot better than it was in my head, and it was a really intense trip. And I think there is this part of me, especially growing up in a youth group culture, where it's like there's always this drive if you're really feeling low to go to the next thing. You know, you faith starts to settle, so you quick go to a conference. Then it starts to settle, so you go to the beach missions trip, and then summer camp. And there's all these like. It's like this really unnatural highs and lows, you know, back and forth. And so it's my first inclination, you know, if I'm feeling this way, then I better go do something to fix it, you know. And so I think there was a part of me that was going to Florida for that. If I could just give myself a change of scenery, if I could just get to the warmth, if I can just get out of this house, out of this cold, then I'll find God again and it'll be fine and everything. And, of course, that's not really how it works. Is it? So that was why I took the trip. And I was writing a completely different book at the time for my book. I was probably, I don't know, a third of the way through it. And it was like just not clicking. It was a several months after the trip, and I was with my writing group, and they were looking at this earlier book that I'd been working on, and just was not clicking, and I was so frustrated. And one of the women in my writing group said, you know, there's so much energy behind your writing from your trip. Maybe you should think about that. And it just, like, instantly I was like, that's it, because it provided such a... Not only was it kind of a powerful time for me in my own faith journey, but it provided a great structure. After writing a first memoir about my entire life, I needed structure. I couldn't go back and do that. So it was kind of fun how it came to be. And
nice. Yeah, having a narrower scope does feel very freeing sometimes of, hey, I'm just writing about this two and a half weeks or however long it was. Yeah, do you have a particular favorite part of that or favorite scene or thing that you really felt great about writing?
No. I have, because the book released so fast, I have a lot of mixed feelings about the book. I mean, yeah, I don't think I have favorite parts of any of my books. I think I look at it and I can see all the ripped out stitches and all the, you know, it's just different as I feel like for me as a writer.
That makes complete sense. I realized if someone had asked me that question, I would have answered the same way, but yet I see yours as so like, oh my gosh, I'm obsessed with this part. Aww. Or, you know, this one scene is everything to me. And you're like, no, all I see are the parts where maybe I could have done it differently or
being a writer is all about this, I think.
Amen. Yes. Yes. That is so true. Yeah, I loved, I forget where I read this, but I think Liz Gilbert talked about in The Signature of All Things, at one point she realized that there was one character that there were some serious issues with, and she just really felt like, maybe I need to take this character out. But then she realized if she did, she'd have to rewrite the entire book. And... you know, it's a huge, huge book. It's hundreds and hundreds of pages. And she basically, I think this was in a Facebook essay, she wrote about, I just decided to embrace my highly imperfect book with this character that didn't quite work, but that was it. That was the book I wrote. You know, deal with it.
I can't do it again. Yeah.
Exactly. And even things like, I know I'm kind of going on a riff here, but I love all of Charlotte Bronte's books, and like the first 100 pages are just so boring. They're just terrible. And that sounds awful, but like the pace of her novels is so different from anything that we do today. It's like the first 100 pages have to really hook you in, right? It's like, no, it is not like that back in the day. So you can even, perceptions of it can even change over time for sure. So. Anyway, sorry, that's my literary geeky side coming out.
Like,
fellow English major, like, let's talk about this. Anyway, so you have written so much about your struggles with traditional spiritual disciplines, like, I need to read the Bible every day. I feel like I can't do it. I need to pray. I feel like I can't pray. And how to wrestle with that. And so I wanted to ask, what are some of the practices that are working for you right now and or advice to people who are also struggling with that?
It really changes for me. Recently I picked up a Lent book that was all the poetry and literature of the Lent season, and that was exactly what I needed. It was so not heavy-handed. It was so just sit with the poem, and that was really helpful for me at that time. Lent was kind of a Lent brings up some feelings for me, so it was just the gentle thing I needed. I I've also been using, there's a spiritual formation Bible that I have that has really, just really gentle questions in the margins. So you can read a verse and think about the question and call it a day, you know. And so I just, you know, some days I just journal, some days I don't journal. I mean, I just have learned to give myself, you know, to have the faith I have and have the journey I have. And I don't know. I guess that takes some time. But you don't have to do anything to make God love you more. And I feel like God will connect with us wherever we can connect. And I am always amazed by how often it just comes out of nowhere, like a TV show or a song or a song that I'm not even looking for. So.
Yes. Oh, exactly. Like, some of my favorite moments in your books are when you are watching The Vampire Diaries or you're listening to Death Cab for Cutie and you're like, oh, here I feel like I met God.
Yeah.
Like, this is not where I expected.
Yeah.
But okay.
Yeah.
I love that.
Go with it.
Yeah. And that also brings up with Lent and everything, this whole idea that I think you talk about it in Night Driving, where often there's this pressure, I need to feel a certain way, or I need to have some kind of religious experience at this time. And what I'm hearing you say is just kind of take the pressure off yourself of just have whatever experience you're having.
Right. Yeah. Just learning to stop trying to muster it up.
Mm-hmm.
Let what happens, happens. I just, growing up the way I did and the way a lot of us did, I think there was, your emotional response was sort of a barometer of your faithfulness, which is so silly because...
Yeah.
Not at all.
So. Yeah. Wow, that is such a good point. And it reminds me of my own counselor is wonderful about, she'll listen to me describe this problem that I think is very complex, and then she'll just be like, you know, I'll say, well, what should I do? I need to do something. She's like, do you?
Yeah.
Like, I think I do. I need to do something to fix it. It's like, what if you let it be what it is? It's like, but I need to be in control.
Therapists are the best.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Mine has, I just love this. She has a little tiny tattoo of an ampersand right on her inner wrist to remind her it's like facing her, not facing outward. The whole, like, it's usually both and, not either or. So not having the black and white thinking and the dualism that gets us so stressed out.
Love that.
Yeah, I just, when I saw that detail, I was like, we're going to be okay together. Like, that's what I need in my life right now. So,
great.
So speaking of people who help you to reframe questions, you recently did a post that I really liked, and I know a lot of other people did too, about reframing the concept of self-care as resourcing. And so can you share, why was that shift really powerful for you? Like, why was that so helpful?
Yeah, that was a huge paradigm shift for me. It's like one word. But you know, when I think about self-care, I tend to think about indulgence. I tend to think about it's unnecessary. It's a little bit selfish. Yes, I need it, but like it can go to the back burner kind of thing. I think I talked about if you watch Parks and Rec, Tom and Donna's Treat Yourself Day, like self-care. The concept feels like to me, like, go buy stuff you don't need because, you know, you're being nice to yourself. And so because of that framing, a lot of my self-care stuff has been actually that good for me, you know, like, I feel like crap, so I'm gonna just, like, go to McDonald's and get french fries because that'll make me feel better for 5 seconds.
Right.
So it's really easy when you talk about self-care to confuse it with I don't know. But anyway, so my spiritual director, she wasn't even trying to give me a new term for it. She just said the term resourcing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a light switched on for me because resourcing is is more about giving yourself what you need to do, what you need to do. And resourcing is about taking care of yourself in a way that is healthy. And it has just been such a powerful concept for me. Like, what is resourcing versus what is not? And how do I build resourcing into my daily life in meaningful ways? So.
Nice. Are there some sort of practical things that you've been building in lately, or other than not eating McDonald's as often, or?
There have been a few things. I've been doing more. I've been taking more time to do like webinars and online workshops and things that feed my writing life, and I've been taking more time to read because that feeds me. I've been. My husband and I actually went on the Whole30, which was something I never thought I would do, but just learning to feed myself well, like physically feed myself good food that's healthy for me, and to learn the sweetness of that. Fruit is so healthy, and it's so and I have been missing it because I've been just stuffing all this, processed chocolate pretendness into my system. So, I'm still learning about it, but it's definitely a shift for me. So.
Yeah. Oh, well, congratulations on that. I know that it's not easy to change habitual patterns. So, hats off to you on all of those things. So I also just wanted, just for fun, to let our listeners know that one of the things you're working on now is you are helping me to edit the draft of my book, which is also a memoir. So other than saving my life on a regular basis, what are you working on now? A writer's least favorite question.
It is. Yeah. It is. You know, I spent this was the first year that both my kids were at school full time. Mm-hmm. So that's been a big shift for me. And I spent the first part of this year, the school year, just really feeling guilty that I wasn't being more productive with all this spacious time. But as I've come into this understanding of resourcing, I'm giving myself a little bit more space to just like breathe and nourish my creativity and play around with stuff. And it was really. That fast turnaround with that second book was just really hard, and blogging as much as I have, I haven't been doing it as much lately, but blogging as much as I have for as long as I have, that's been kind of a lot. So I'm doing a little more resting than I thought I would be doing, a little more reading, a little more stuff like that. I am working on a little fiction, which has been a fun project. I need a little time before I write another memoir, I think.
Sure.
We need to live some more life now, so.
Yes.
But I have some other ideas in mind. I feel like I'm getting inspired again, which feels great. So I'm just taking my time.
I am so glad to hear that. I'm really excited to read the future fiction someday. Because I feel like so many of my favorite spiritual writers, we have Madeleine Longell or Frederick Buechner, like they all have done the memoir and they do the fiction. So I'm very excited for that. Yeah. But it takes a lot of courage to like allow yourself that space and that resourcing. And I totally have that. I need to be productive and I need to be producing this much. And it's like, well, what if you gave yourself time? And what if you didn't feel like a crazy person while you were working? Like, wouldn't that be great, too?
Especially when you're a goal-oriented person. Creativity is so, it's just a slow process. And you can't really rush it. I mean, any writer knows. You sit down and think you're going to get something done, and then you delete a whole chapter. It's just like 1,000 steps back, and so I think trying to make peace with that process is important.
Very, very. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but just what you shared about your second memoir of like, I was a third of the way through, and then I realized, oh, wait, this isn't actually the book I'm supposed to write. Not right now.
Fun times.
Yeah, having the integrity to do that and just be like, I know I put a lot into this. I know I have a lot of pages saved on my computer, but I have to just trust that, that's what I needed to do to get here. So, last question, hypothetical. If you could travel back in time and give any words of wisdom to your younger self, is there anything in particular that you would tell her?
I never know what to say on this question. People ask it a lot. I was what have you watched 13 Reasons Why on Netflix yet?
I haven't, but I know the plot line. Like, I've read about what it's about.
Well, this has nothing to do with the plot line, but there was this one moment, and the main character kid gets drunk for the first time, and he shows up at home, and he's a mess, and he pukes all over the table. And then the next morning, his dad comes in, and he's like, "How you feeling?" And he's like, "Bad."
Not good.
And his dad's like, "There's an important lesson in a hangover." And the kid's like, "What? Don't drink?" And the dad goes, "No, you'll drink. It happens." And then he talks about the lesson of the hangover is that actions have consequences. But I just love that. You'll drink. It happens. You'll sin. It happens. You'll screw up. It happens. I think, especially my particular experience of the evangelical on fire faith stuff, your personal piety and purity was so tied up in your relationship with Jesus. And so, like, if one failed, then, and it made me like a really fearful person. It made me a very uncompassionate person. When, close friends, for example, did not wait for their wedding night to, I didn't know what to do with that because in my mind it was so tied up to my relationship with God. I wish somebody would have said to me, "You'll make out a lot. It
It
happens.
happens,
Great. It happens. There. You'll stop feeling God. It happens, and it's okay. It's just part of it. It's okay. I don't know if I would have heard it, but I feel like if enough people had been, I don't know. I feel like with our youth, we're so nervous that they're going to like go off this path. And like I can't really, I don't have teenagers yet, so I know it's coming.
It's coming.
Consequences. There are consequences to things. And but I also think that when you go off the path, it doesn't mean that God is any farther away from you. That's where grace comes in. And for people who talk so much about grace, we really didn't do a good job of drilling that into our kids, at least when I was in the youth group situation. So that's all I've got.
That's perfect. That's perfect. And it reminds me, you've written a lot about that cliche, that phrase of if you feel far from God, guess who moved? And how this is the opposite of that, basically. Yeah. Well, I think you are going to enjoy, there's a scene in my current draft where one of my best friends, Brooke, is comforting me because I am freaking out about I've taken too many shots. I've made out with someone. Oh my God, now I'm the worst person in the world and I don't deserve to live and everything. And this is in college. This is a long time ago. And, I am just castigating myself. I'm so broken up about this and just very, very harsh and very judgmental. And there's no grace there. And I will never forget her just looking at me and going, "I don't think God is mad at you." And I was like, "Really?" This was shocking to me. She's like, "I'm not mad at all." And she's like, "I think God is, he's got it covered, bigger than me," that kind of thing. And I was like, "That's very comforting. I wish I could believe that. Like, that's really nice." So, yeah, that's one of those you learn so much more sometimes by, obviously you don't want to have to go off the path and deal with the hangover and everything, but I don't know that I would have learned that another way.
Exactly.
So, wow. Okay. I could talk to you all day, clearly, but yeah. Anything else that you want to add? Any stories you want to tell or things that we didn't cover?
Okay.
Yeah.
I stayed up all night painting my kid's room, so I'm like...
Yes, and before we started, you had panned out and showed me all of the kids' toys that you were organizing, so yeah. I know you have a full plate. There's plenty to deal with at the Zierman house right now.
I do that, but it's fine.
But yeah.
I just organized the whole house in one day.
Yes, that's another thing I could have talked about here, but kind of the violence of expectations that are too high. Like, there's this great Thomas Merton quote about how when we try and do too much, it's a kind of violence toward ourselves. And I know I'm so liable to fall into that of, no problem, I'll just clean the whole house in one day. And it's like, Don't do it.
I can't move my legs.
Right, exactly. It's like, this is not kind.
Yeah, definitely. But almost done, so.
Well, thank you so much. And I can't wait to get this published on the blog. And we will give away either a copy of When We Were on Fire or Night Driving to a lucky reader, so folks can enter in the comments. But thank you so much, Addie.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.